This is Reimagining Higher Education, your go-to podcast with remarkable education leaders sharing personal stories from their experience in and around the sector, including reflection and hope for progress in the sector. With your host, Professor Judith Sachs, former PVC Learning and Teaching at the University of Sydney, Deputy Vice Chancellor and Provost at Macquarie University, and Special Advisor in Higher Education at KPMG, and now Chief Academic Officer at Studiosity. Welcome.
It gives me a great pleasure to talk to the Vice Chancellor of University of Tasmania, Professor Rufus Black. Rufus has had a most interesting and diverse career, and I'll get Rufus to talk about how he's got to where he is now. But I've invited him to bring an object that represents part of that journey to being a learner and a leader. So, Rufus, over to you.
Great. Thank you, Judith. And I have a great pleasure to join you. The object that I have here is a Tasmanian Aboriginal water carrier made of kelp. Let's give him the picture, which was gifted to me when I started this job. For me, this represents a number of really important pieces. The first is just a recognition in anything I do that we start in Australia with the humility that we're on other people's country, invaded and dispossessed country, and acknowledge the owners who are here. I think as education institutions, as leaders, that's where we need to start. That's where our identity needs to begin. But equally, this is about different knowledge systems. And my journey as a learner and indeed as a leader has an awful lot to do with how to embrace different understandings of the world and of reality. Academically, a major part of my history is as a theologian. But I do that in a thoroughly secular world and have lived most of my life in thoroughly secular environments. And in lots of ways, my own kind of learning and leadership journey has been about crossing different kind of knowledge systems that exist even within our own kind of broadly Western kind of conceptions. But I've spent time working in Southeast Asia and deep engagements with Indigenous peoples. My own school experience, I studied history at school, did lots of Asian studies when I was at university. I've been deeply enriched and very influenced by these different knowledge systems. Indeed, even as a university student back in the 80s, early 90s, actually studied Aboriginal law and indeed Indigenous law in Southeast Asia to understand how systems in Southeast Asia incorporated Indigenous law constructs into their systems, the way of informing ourselves. This is back in the late 80s, early 90s. So it's been a very deep, long-term interest about how we produce a multi-perspectival kind of view of the world. And part of why I bring this one forward is in the work that I'm at about where the future needs to go. While I have a very strong set of views about the transformations that are needed and the knowledges that we currently have will help with that, I ultimately have a view that we will only get to a sustainable planet when our current kind of broadly modernist Western knowledges are in deep conversation with Indigenous epistemologies that actually will help us reconceive the world in relational terms. Only then are we likely to produce a knowledge system that will enable us to live sustainably on the planet. And I see one of my absolutely fundamental roles as a leader as to help institutions and my institution engage in the kind of conversations that will support that very multidimensional transformation the world needs to urgently make between now and 2050 to a much more sustainable planet. And Indigenous knowledge systems, in my view, are foundational to that journey. So that's where this kind of piece is a sort of symbol of something very much larger. That might be to weigh into our conversation.
And that's wonderful. And that sense of drawing on the past to craft the future is, and using Indigenous knowledges as a different lens to actually craft that future. Can you elaborate on the sort of response that you've had to this sort of what some people would see as unorthodox, some people would see as deeply exciting, and other people would see as don't know what to do with it?
Well, at least in a kind of University of Tasmania context, it's been extremely well received, that kind of line of thought. We've had, as a university, shortly after I arrived, we engaged in an institutional apology to Aboriginal people for the role we played in the violation of their rights in parts of our, particularly early parts of our history, though, even into more contemporary times. I have a wonderful group of colleagues who've been committed to the indigenisation of parts of our curricula and a broad commitment as institutionally to doing that holistically. The capacity of our Indigenous knowledge holders and Western science thinkers to bring different kinds of knowledges together in particular places have already shown the huge opportunities that come from these different kind of ways of framing understandings and the knowledges that they're held in. So in that context, raising this has not been, it's been well received. I think, in fact, if you didn't have an element of that, people might think you were not really working with the identity that we have and seek to build here. And more broadly in Tasmania, at least in kind of a broad range of environments, that positioning is very well received.
So what I'm interested in when I hear this, and I'm actually very enthusiastic and excited about what you're saying and trying to imagine it happening in other places. So was it actually you as a leader who brought this as one of your foundational principles about your leadership? And was the time right for the university and the community to accept it?
I don't think you can. I have a big view about organisations that you basically have to work with their DNA. And I couldn't do these things if there weren't already kind of really deep commitments and deeply committed people. And as a leader, all one's really doing is kind of in lots of ways in these spaces, enabling the strength of others. I did make it an important feature of how I wanted the signals I wanted to send. So when I began here, I didn't start at our main campus in Hobart. My first day, my first hour in the job was actually on a beach in the northwest of the state, our least advantaged kind of area where we do have a campus. Before I came onto the university, being welcomed to country on the beach as the sun came up by the Palawapakana people of the northwest. And indeed, that forged a connection with the people who did that welcome. That's become personally profoundly significant to me. And so it was really about indicating a different set of priorities about what mattered. And then each other campus, my starting point was to ensure I wasn't coming onto the campus till I was welcomed onto country and had to be worthy you were welcomed onto country. You had to kind of form a view that was an okay thing to do. So it sends a certain kind of signal that there's no grand ceremonial installations or other things. It starts on a beach at sunrise with Aboriginal people.
And it's real. It's not some sort of something, well, it does have an historical context, but the context is before our time. And so it's extraordinarily powerful. So,
and you're accountable. If you do that from the beginning, you're accountable. Those relationships are personal and they matter. So that holds you personally and indeed institutionally accountable for ensuring that those commitments are lived to the greatest extent you can.
So what was it about your education, both undergraduate and postgraduate, but also your upbringing, that have given you this extraordinarily strong moral compass, but this great commitment to important issues of our time? The fact that you've got that image behind you that speaks to the environment is also a very profound message to me, having a conversation with you.
Yeah, so the image behind me, yeah, this is kelp. These are the kind of tropical rainforests of the ocean, really. And we do work not just to understand this kind of extraordinary environment, but to regenerate it. So our folk, you know, Tasmania's waters are some of the most affected in the world by rising sea temperatures and led to the loss of the giant kelp, which is literally like filling a rainforest, the kind of loss of species that go with that. And our kind of incredible people have found some remnant elements of it, that its genetic structure enables them to survive better in the warmer water. And we are literally regenerating effectively the ocean's rainforests here. So where does all that come from?
And you're being the steward for this sort of thinking and this sort of connection with community.
Yeah. So you know, family of origin is always quite important in these things. I grew up in a household with a mother who was an artist, and who kind of taught me deeply about kind of seeing the world through the eyes of artists. And a father who was a barrister who ended up arguing in a whole series and being involved in a whole series of very significant environmental fights. So he wrote, being part of the submission of the Project Jonah, which led to Australia being declared a whale sanctuary. That meant I learned when I was in primary school a lot about whales, and sold Save the Whale badges to raise money for whales in the playground when I was a primary school kid. I loved the ocean, spent a lot of time as a kid in the ocean. So the idea that these great creatures needed protection just was the most natural thing in the world to want to know. And I knew waters that I swam in very, very well. And so I had a kind of almost personal affection for the, well, I would say personal affection for the creatures in those waters. And he then went on to represent the Wilderness Society in the dams case. And so when you're growing up as a young teenager in the thick of recognizing that these are things you can fight for and you can win, there are, you know, the environment can be saved. And he was then involved in work on the Lemontine Forest, the Daintree Forest. So, you know, my walls end up covered with pictures of these very special places. And that just ignites a kind of deep, a really, really deep, deep interest. And I guess as part of that, I had an awakening really about Aboriginal people, that, you know, look, my grandfather on my mother's side had actually, they had, and you know, there are definitely problems with this, but they had a very substantial collection of Aboriginal stone tools, all happily, I must say now, appropriately, you know, restored to their right places. But that ignited as a child like a profound awareness that this was a Aboriginal peoples across the country had these very rich, sophisticated, profound relationships with country, which I wouldn't have articulated in that language then, but were very apparent in my growing up world. So it was just part of my mental model of life that that's how the world was. So and I didn't get any real opportunities to pursue that at school, but pretty much as soon as you get to university, I remember in my first year law class, one of Henry Reynolds' books was on the agenda because it was dealing, you know, it was legal history kind of subject taught by the completely remarkable legal historian Robin Sharwood, who used to get standing ovations and applause at the end of virtually every lecture. unbelievable, just a compelling storyteller himself. But Henry Reynolds' work was on that agenda, and obviously that then put it all together for me, and I could see the issues of profound justice that were therefore at the heart of this, and that took the interest to the next level. Indeed, as an undergraduate, I wrote a final year thesis on recognizing Aboriginal ownership in the Constitution. How would you do it? My proposal back then was rather modest. How would it be included in the preamble, and what would be the constitutional implications of that? But this stuff, you know, that's kind of very early 90s. So these things have been kind of foundational in my thinking. And, you know, my theological interests, which are, you know, I'm broad and liberal, and at times have been, you know, publicly doubted that I was even a Christian by. I didn't, it was very famous prayer breakfast here where I got invited to speak, and a bunch of the Christian leaders in Hobart said, "No, you can't invite him, he's not a Christian." Which is pretty interesting given that I'm ordained. But anyway, it goes to the kind of it's extremely progressive nature of my views. But though that view does incorporate the fact that the early on I came to understand that the spiritualities of other peoples, were profoundly illuminating of the nature of reality itself. So back then, again, in my kind of postgraduate, undergrad, late undergraduate, postgraduate years, the idea of other knowledge is revealing the most profound things we can know. That's very formative again in my thinking, even if today I do that in a much, much more secular context.
So you've been a progressive. I mean, you are a progressive, both in terms of your theological views, but also in your administrative and leadership views. And that's created some tensions within and between the university and the community. How have you managed to resolve those tensions, particularly about, you know, the most progressive thing that you wanted to do was relocate the university, and there was some significant pushback by the community. So how have you managed those tensions and those as part of your leadership and as part of your being a significant person in both the community of Hobart, but in the broader context of Tasmania and Australia?
The tensions, in lots of ways, I think they reflect some other kind of more profound, cultural challenges that you kind of come across. And there isn't a simple diagnosis of why that tension is there and exists. It's very multifactorial. You know, inevitably, when you get something like that, you know, I'm very humble about, okay, here's a whole series of things that needed to be understood more deeply and profoundly. And they cover a broad range. And they go to, I mean, they go to questions that are quite, you know, I think the whole sector needs to wrestle with. You know, on the one hand, there is a deep and very understandable commitment to an idea of universities that really belong to the era of elite universities in Australia, where they were singular places, largely people from school studying full time, with much better government support for students, so many fewer people working. Very different kind of world, which much smaller institutions, much more personal. And in some ways, our Sandy Bay campus, which is very unchanged from that era, summarizes that era. So the idea that we might move away from it was like an idea that we were moving away from the very ideal that people probably carry around in their heads, both staff and indeed alumni, and particularly alumni. And of course, Australia's moved enormously from then. You know, we are many times larger. We're serving a much bigger population. They're part-time. You know, only 20% of our students are school leavers because we're serving people necessarily right across the age cohorts. They come from very different places. So the need, one of my profound learnings is the need to be actually taking the time to help come on the journey as to what has really changed in terms of our identity, and being respectful of the fact that identity we did have was valuable and valued still. But the social reality of what higher education is doing has evolved dramatically. So there's one piece of this, which is about the identity of the sector and the fact as a society, we have not helped people adapt to that change. And I think, you know, Michael Wesley's book, Mind of the Nation, is a wonderful kind of exposition of that journey and the fact that neither government nor the sector have taken people on that journey adequately. And this was just a lightning rod in a way of that bigger problem. The second piece really is also Hobart as a city. Its last serious plan was 1945. And it doesn't have a plan for what it's going to become. So when a university makes a plan, it really ends up in the space that is a genuine community task. What kind of place do we want to be? That's a community choice, not a university choice. And we ended up effectively framing the community choice, and quite understandably, a group of people therefore raised all sorts of issues to do with how you plan a city, which in lots of ways, you know, they're worried about parking and transport and all manner of things. Once you see that, you kind of quickly you start to recognize these changes need to be driven by city plans. And there was no proper plan for Sandy Bay. So when we proposed what the future of the Sandy Bay campus would be, which anyone who's looked at the plans that evolved from that, which involved a lot of consultation, a lot of engagement, would say that is as good a plan as you'll ever get in terms of very deeply thoughtful, environmentally sensitive, community sensitive development, but, you know, deeply objected to. If the city hasn't helped a community come on a journey about the plans it needs, then your role at university is not to do that. Look, profound learnings about what the kind of shape of institutions in a setting like this. This wouldn't have happened in other at least in various other cities. But it reflects something that's, I think, important, necessary, which is this attention to the broader ecology that universities are a part of, and the, you know, deeply nuanced work that can be sometimes. I would say that it ends up community objection here. The other thing is, it does become, you know, it certainly does become very personal. And I think many of the big folks who would, criticise me would have no idea about the kind of views we just talked about. It's not their lenses; they don't see you through. So you might see a progressive. I don't think that's what they've necessarily seen, and you lose the person in the fight, and that's a bit sad.
But clearly there are some underlying assumptions that you have about the student experience and what sort of experience you want your graduates to have and how they then become advocates and contributors to the broader society, both locally and nationally. So what are some of the assumptions that have been sort of either tacit or implicit in your vision for, your view of reimagining higher education?
Yeah, so kind of a number of lenses on this, I think. The first of them really is that, and I really welcome the Accord as a fantastically important document, and I think restores purpose at a much deeper level to the sector. Higher education is life transformative. And in the world that we've got now, it is vital that transformative opportunity is available to as many people as possible, because the way our economy and society has evolved, you will need knowledge to enable to access the resource and everything else that make for a good life. We risk radically bifurcating society if we don't do this. It's bifurcated enough here in Tasmania. The gap between life expectancy in our Sandy Bay campus, where we live here, and just 20 Ks or so down the road out at Bridgewater, is 20 years. 20 years. That's the difference that you normally find between developed and developing countries. So the inequalities that are present because education is absent are radical in Australia and getting worse. So if we want to be a kind of an inclusive and fair society, this has to change. And it is higher education, you know, we've got to get through schools. Schools have to go do better than they're currently doing. And then higher education has to do a lot better than it's currently doing. So that kind of fundamental justice piece for me is absolutely central. We have to create that level of access, and for all people. I'm dyslexic. Educational journey was an absolute nightmare for much of my journey as a result, until, interestingly, I got to Oxford, where they're familiar with dyslexic people, and I was able to thrive at a whole new level, because, in fact, neurodiversity was, you know, a near normal thing. Because oddly, you know, neurodiversity brings a whole bunch of advantages, not just challenges. But it has to be really inclusive, and that's critical. So that's one thing that's really important to me, is that, and that is part of why I think we've got to locate universities in places that are genuinely accessible. That's really important, and eliminate it and work on every other barrier. That's just one of many barriers. I do think we're in a particular area where this transition to a sustainable planet that we've got to make by 2050, you know, we've been talking as a whole university around that challenge. That's the reframe, that's the frame for our strategic refresh. You know, the basic model of an economy we've got is ecologically and socially completely unsustainable. It's got us this far. It won't get us, it isn't getting us much further without absolutely problematic levels of environmental and social harm. The transformation to, you know, a sustainable, inclusive, prosperous, resilient society requires lots of new levels of knowledge, skills, capabilities as we build zero carbon, circular, regenerative. This is a, you know, a rare moment where we have to be re-educating ourselves and our communities in rapidly and in bold ways. So that commitment to sustainability in its fullest sense and the kind of radical urgency of it certainly is a central kind of plank. And then, and it's great, University of Tasmania, one of the things that's very nice about it is we have to serve the full mission of higher education. So that does mean I am a great defender of a whole range of the humanities and social sciences and creative arts, not because they lead you to a job, but because it's a mark of the kind of society you are, whether you choose to have those things in your society. This is a choice that you have about what kind of community you want to be, not what kind of jobs you've got, what kind of community you want to be. So I'm very resistant to the idea that everything has to be vocational. No, first and foremost, those things are expressions of our identity as a community. But equally, we've got to have good nurses and doctors and lawyers, and they better be really good at their job, because I don't want to be operated on by somebody who's not really good at their job. You know, and when you are cared for by people who don't have the best, latest knowledge. And for me, that one of the things that brings home is universities are very plural places. And I think one of the things that's gone wrong in higher education, you know, Australia chose to go to create mass higher education by making big institutions. That wasn't how we expanded originally. We made more institutions. But instead of doing that, we forced a number of them together and made them vast. And they're way too big. And what they encourage is a kind of managerial homogenization. And that's really a problem. And they become large and they have big sections in the middle, because you know, you need a big span breaker. If you've got, you know, 20, 30 academic units, each of which could be quite distinctive in its identity, you end up putting big, you know, you put colleges or whatever the other structure is in the middle, but then you've got a lot of layers. And that necessarily creates hierarchy and bureaucracy. And at least for me, that's an anathema to what you want a university to be about. And until I did this job, I had resisted being a part of any of the big bits of universities. You know, I was deeply involved in University College. Why? Because it was a community which could be a genuine community. Everyone could know everyone. You could be connected. You could have one conversation. You could care for people in the way that's about. Most of my life has been spent lived in small groups, not really big groups. And we've got to find a way to make universities smaller again. And it's not easy. The kind of momentum to scale is huge in the policy, every setting we deal with, but I'm not giving up on that.
So two more questions to finish off. What advice would you give to the class of graduating students of 2024 about how to take on the issues and challenges that you've talked to me about today?
My advice to them was to see this as an era of opportunity for the remaking of the world. You could certainly see it through the lens of pessimism, and I get that, and of kind of anger. I get that too. It's a generation that's been bequeathed a monumental set of failings by the generation that's been ahead of it. This is not a sustainable planet or a sustainable model we've left them. We've left them in situations of inequality and intergenerational inequality. I get that that's a cause for anger and a sense of injustice. But equally, the pressures now are so great, the world has to change. And so this is a generation that could remake the world. And one of the things which I never go to sleep without hope, because this is an incredibly talented, creative generation. If I was going to entrust anybody to remake the world, I'd trust them. Their values are incredibly sound. Their passions are strong. Their relationships are, you know, networked and not hierarchical. They value different kinds of knowledge. They want to be inclusive. What a generation. I think they're amazing. And so I would, my thing is I trust you. My thing is I trust you guys to remake the world. Please see it as opportunity. And see those of us who are still involved as your collaborators to help you remake it, because it is going to be up to you.
Well, my last question was going to be what advice would you give to the younger Rufus? But I think that your advice to current students is just inspirational. So if you want to answer the question about the advice to the younger Rufus, I'm happy to hear it.
We'll give myself the same advice then.
Rufus, this has been a wonderful way to spend 40 minutes on a Friday afternoon. Thank you for your thoughtful, your provocative, but your passionate view about the role of the university and the community, but also trusting the next generation of students. I found that inspirational. So thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for your time today as well.
You have been listening to Studiosity's podcast, Reimagining Higher Education, candid conversations within higher education, sharing stories of leadership, change, and best practice in teaching and learning. Visit studiosity.com.